Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fandy Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Rachel.
And we're here today with two special guests, Stina. Hello, Stina.
Hello.
And Peter. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
So we got a very special topic today, but before we dive into the specifics, we should say that this episode is likely to contain some conversation about difficult subjects, including, as the title of the podcast will suggest, traumatic subjects. So if things like sexual assault, etc., may be a trigger for you, this may be a good point to sort of bow out, and just as a kind of just a warning so that, you know, you're not surprised by anything. So to kind of start off with, I know that both Stina and Peter have written different traumatic subjects, including things such as suicide. I know, Stina, in some of your earlier work, you included basically prison rape, and other very difficult subjects, including historical subjects. And so I wanted to have a conversation briefly with you two about the difficulties you had in writing some of those subjects. And so I wanted to start with you, Peter, because you have dealt with, as I mentioned, right, suicide is a topic that has come up in your work. And what was some of the difficulties for you in writing about those particular subjects?
Well, with suicide in particular, it was always the case with the narrative arc for my series that it was part of the sort of motivation, I guess, and the early life of one of my central characters. I crafted a second world that's particularly hard for children, and there's human trafficking that goes on, and for very specific reasons. And so this character, as it gets into the second volume of the series, with some restored memory and sort of encountering friends from an earlier part of his life, kind of comes face to face again with suicide. And while that had always been the plan, that was always, he was going to start plumbing those depths. What made it poignant was in the writing, early writing of the second book, a good friend of mine committed suicide. And, I thought I went through the stages of grief like you do. And it was hard and those kinds of things. When I went back though, and was kind of doing edits on the book, I saw how deeply it had gotten into the narrative. I'm glad it did, because as I was sort of confronting it, more as a reader the second time than as a writer, I would have been ashamed if I had not sort of put it on the page honestly. And that's not self-congratulation. I'm just fortunate it happened that way. But the interesting part of the story is that I do teaching sometimes, and I taught a class that this friend of mine had attended, and one of the techniques I use is I have the students write themselves a letter about what they hope to glean from the course or the class, and what their goals are and where they see themselves in years ahead. And then I take those and I put them safely away, and I mail them back to the student, 10, 20 years down the line, so they can kind of get a letter from their past and find out how they're doing against the goals they set. And I had this incredibly, incredibly painful moment when just after I had completed edits on the book, where I found those letters, and this friend of mine had written a letter, and he had committed suicide, and he had no next of kin, and I really was puzzled. I didn't know what to do with this letter, and I finally elected to open it, and it was heart-wrenching because he had written. I'm gonna get emotional. He had written in this letter about how he just hoped that he could not commit suicide. He didn't have grand dreams. He just wanted to suffer through what he was going through. He was actually a Vietnam War veteran. He lost his battle with that desire and he committed suicide. That just knocked the wind out of me for a long time. And it makes me look at topics like this very differently.
So, wow. That was very unexpected. Obviously, it may not have been the intent for it to be deeply personal at first, but as you have worked through your novel, it has become that because it has become something that was obviously very emotional for you. I'm assuming that has actually affected the writing, that you maybe see how you write about these subjects in a very different way than you might have before.
Yeah, you know, I by the way, none of this is a soapbox. None of it's intended to tell other writers how they should treat their craft. I just know for me that there are subjects now that I can't just write blithely because it's a good plot point. I personally can't do it.
See, and I can't either I agree with you.
So this is, you know, and I don't know, I don't read broadly enough to know how often suicide is taken as a subject matter, and it's not the only topic that's sensitive and painful. I just know that, you know, there's another side of this coin for the person who is struggling with their own thoughts of suicide. And I'm sure there are writers who have or are in this boat now. Or have tried it. The tack that my side of the coin is the coin where someone that I cared for did this, and I was left with the feelings that I should have been a better friend, and maybe they'd be alive if I was. And those are damning thoughts to live with.
Yeah, I would imagine extremely difficult to live with. Stina, I want to get you in here because you had made a comment earlier, and I know from your own work, not least of all because in your work you've dealt with very sensitive historical periods, and it was very important to you. I think even on SF Signal recently, The Three Horsemen, you talked about how important it was for you to get the history right. And I know in your work you've dealt with some very difficult subjects, not least of all the Irish Troubles and so on, and you had said that for you, it was not something you could come to blithely when it came to some of these difficult subjects. And what was the journey like for you in sort of approaching, say, for example, in your first novel, you actually have a character who is raped in prison.
Okay. The reason I decided to write about that is because rape is treated so cavalierly in science fiction and fantasy, both. It made me very, very angry. It makes me very, very angry because it is treated so for me, the tipping point was watching, I can't remember the name of the film. The post-apocalyptic film with the blind dude
who's carrying around.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So I couldn't sit through it. I got about through the first third of the film, and I think there were five different attempts at rape, and I had to get up and leave. And my husband stayed to watch it, and I just stayed out in the lobby. And that was just that was it. I was done. I wanted to show men what that felt like ultimately. So I took it. That was always in the back of my head, before I even got to Of Blood and Honey. But when I started researching the Irish Troubles and the conditions in Longcash, it became extremely apparent to me that that was what was going on in the prison. And it was the guards raping the prisoners, not the prisoners raping each other. But it's never explicitly stated. So I decided that I would write about that, but I wanted to do it. And it was just very, very difficult for me to do. It really, really was. I do have some sexual assault in my background, in my past. I'm sure it's probably very obvious to everyone that it's there, but, And I did tap on that when I wrote about it. But I wanted to be very careful not to make it titillating in any way. So I focused on the psychological aspects of it and the psychological aftermath. And I made damn sure I didn't make that exciting or interesting in any way. I punched hard. I didn't pull that punch at all. For that reason. So there you are.
Okay. So let's do take a little bit of a step back and kind of look at, on a more general scale, since this is about writing. I wanted to talk a little bit about what are some of the specific difficulties in approaching any kind of a traumatic subject, whatever it may be. It could be historical, it could be sort of personal, because obviously, like Stina has brought up, right, that rape in particular is kind of treated very flippantly, right? It's just kind of a thing that's used in many cases as shock value. We've seen this in the case of Game of Thrones very recently. Well, I shouldn't say very recently, maybe since that show's been running.
Constantly.
We're seeing that, and that's a conversation that's come up a lot, right, that subjects like rape or even perhaps suicide and other kinds of traumatic subjects are treated very poorly. They're treated as shock value versus treated maybe as a subject of, well, deep pain or discomfort, as it were. And so I'll start with you, Peter, and then Rachel, of course, if you would like to jump in at any point, please do. But I mean, from your perspective, what are some of the difficulties in kind of approaching these kinds of subjects? I'll start there.
Well, I mean, I think what's interesting about the question is, I'm not convinced that in the main, as a community of writers, we are always as troubled in writing about traumatic subjects as we probably should be.
No.
Maybe expand on that a little bit and kind of, well, yeah.
Like the example I give here is we write about death. Just recently I've gone on a spate of watching Westerns. And it's interesting to me that in a lot of the storytelling not so long ago, that the loss of a single life was a big deal. And the exploration of the consequences of that, could be, heartrending and meaningful. And in a lot of the books, more contemporary books, there's so much death. And I wrote about this recently, cause I had another, you know, I'm at a stage in life where I've got, people who are beginning to die because they're older. And I sat at a funeral, my father-in-law, and, I watched, he was a military man, and I watched the soldiers fold his flag, and I watched a soldier stand at attention at the foot of his grave for 20 minutes without moving an inch, and I listened to taps played in a cemetery, and I started reflecting on his personal sacrifice, which, and just the loss of a single life and the repercussions of that in terms of the how it resonates in the heart of so many people that were touched and moved and saddened. And so then when I go back to my own fiction, and there's so much death, you know, just death, death, death. And you named some shows that are doing that a ton. And sometimes there's a life over which the characters grieve for moments. And then there's a lot of lives that are seen as, you know, easy to dispense with. And
yeah, in the same way.
Yeah. And in the same way that like props. And I'm not saying that every single death in every single book needs to have a chapter devoted to the grief, you know, for that single life. But it made me think differently about even death, because like, how often do we consider that a traumatic thing? Especially in this country, we're much more concerned with sex than we are with violence.
Yep.
So I just, you know, that when you ask the question, and I know that there are writers who do this thoughtfully, but I read a lot of books where death is pretty casual. And in some ways, I think it's unfortunate. At the very least, it's a missed opportunity for a writer to really kind of get into the nitty gritty of probably one of the most traumatic things that happens in the course of a life. And I know this sounds super preachy and high-minded, and I really don't mean it to be, but it's just another thing where personal experience has begun to inform the ways I can and can't treat certain elements of fiction. And I can't be a 25-year-old again who thinks it's cool just to see lots of death dealt and no consequence or no mourning or no grief. It's just, for me, that doesn't resonate as true anymore.
Yeah, I think it's just part of that is maturing as a person and a writer, right?
Yeah, you're probably right. And you know what? By the way, again, there's a whole strata of books that probably deal a lot of death, and they have and they're done great, and there's a lot of readers for them. I think I'm just kind of at a place personally right now where the books I want to write and the books I want to read are going to plumb the depth of what that means, and try and show it not as again as like what I call a plot point, and more as like, you know, real consequence on the page. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. Rachel, I see you wanted to jump in and might have another question you wanted to raise in this context.
I mean, I wonder how much of this, you know, you talk about the casual way with which death is treated in fiction. I wonder how much of that is there's, you know, particularly in American culture, there's almost this romanticization of violence, to where, yeah, it is kind of like, you know, particularly in popular media, death is treated as a very casual thing. And kind of like the best example I like to pull of this is there's this Canadian cop show called Flashpoint that you can watch on Netflix. And I did not realize that it was Canadian at first until I watched the first episode, and it's about a SWAT team. So you're like, okay, you know, people are going to get shot. But in the first episode, the target that's already murdered some people, he gets shot in the head, and then that one death is a through line in the plot for the rest of the season, and most of the episodes don't actually end up with, you know, the police killing someone. And it just struck me so much because, like, say in the U.S. we're used to cop shows are always, you know, somebody's going to get shot by the police, particularly if it's about like a SWAT team situation. And I'm just wondering anyway, if it's just that we're seeing violence treated as so casually and as particularly in many ways as a kind of shorthand, if you think that is connected in particular to the casual way that death and particularly violent death is treated.
Yeah, I'm not qualified to make anything other than amateur commentary on the nature of you know, American society. But I will say that it seems true to me that, you know, if we've gotten into this thing where if one death is shocking, two deaths is more shocking. And then the escalation becomes silly. At some point, you know, you fill up your frames with death and mayhem. And at that point, like, there's no time in your narrative construct to examine the repercussions in the lives of people who loved those who've been lost. And, you know, this is a place where fiction is not imitating life. Because, you know, while there are unmourned for deaths for sure, like usually when someone passes, there's a social network around them that grieves. And all books can't and shouldn't be about nothing but grief. But if part of a book is going to have that, like I said before, I think there's an emotional resonance as a writer opportunity that's missed if the death just happens as a piece of glory on the page without, you know, talking at all about, you know, the emotional damage that's left behind. The highest marks I got from my last book were for scenes where two people were kind of confronting that. Like the scene I cried writing was the scene where my main character, who's confronting the fact that he wasn't there when a good friend of his lost his mother to suicide, is confronting what it means to be a friend in those kind of sort of extreme life conditions. Similarly with relationships between a father and a daughter. And those, you know, at the end of the day, to be honest with you, that's the reason I'm writing anymore. It's for those moments that are charged emotionally like that. It's sensationalizing things in grand scale war and epic like that. That's easy. That's the easy stuff, man. The hard stuff is to get down to the metal where the emotions are raw and you can tell on the page that even if the writer hasn't, you don't have to have tried to commit suicide to really plumb the sort of the human condition there and think about it and what that means. And I just adore writers who are willing to take those kinds of personal risks with their fiction.
Yeah, for me, there's a book called On Violence, which I found rather interesting reading. I believe the author's Grossman, Lieutenant Colonel Grossman. He makes some really interesting points about violence in America. If you're interested, it's a great nonfiction book based on all of that. I think he comes to some rather, he makes some rather spurious conclusions, I think, as far as video games go, because it has been proven that exposure to violence actually is not does not have a permanent effect. I know this from personal experience because I went without a television for an entire year and actually was desaturated during that time and didn't even know it. And then one day somebody gave me a television set, and so I started watching television again, and the violence on television alone, just normal American programming, really hammered me for that first month. So it's not a permanent psychological effect. It is definitely it does have an effect, but it's not a permanent one. But it's a really interesting read. Also, I want to bring up, there's a very interesting effect, at least in human beings, that one death can be so powerful, such a powerful thing, and yet millions not so much. I'm sure everybody here has watched the movie Schindler's List.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, and there's that really just moving, amazing, beautifully executed scene where you see the little girl in the pink coat. Everything is in black and white. All the action is in black and white. People are being murdered left and right in black and white, and there's this little girl in a pink coat who is wandering around through all of that. So you focus, without meaning to, on one individual. And when you see that pink coat show up in that pile of bodies later, it really hammers you. Or it did me, anyway. That yeah. was... that was really amazing.
The advice I've given writers, and I can't, others will decide if I'm successful at it, but that I try to weave into my fiction, which is to typify the loss of many lives by showing one. If you show a single father grieving over the loss of his son on the battlefield, and you make that poignant and heartbreaking, and then you kind of pan out and you allow the reader to then see that there are thousands of fathers and mothers who've lost thousands of sons and daughters, you know, then the mind can start to say, holy shit. Right. But if all you do is show like a fireball screeching down and killing 10,000 people, that's just a sentence on the page that doesn't mean anything.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that, the example that's, brought up, that, trying to make sense of, say, for example, genocide, the extermination of millions of people, that Spielberg makes the choice to focus in such a way that we actually have the emotional impact for what is essentially massive amounts of death. Like, as you say, right, Peter, when we're talking about this idea that we just have a fireball and like millions, it just tells us millions die, that doesn't have it's not personalized, it's sort of faces, like without faces, it's just blurred faces.
They're just numbers.
Yeah, that becomes numbers versus, as Schindler's List does it really remarkably well, right? Tries to find ways to personalize mass violence that connects with us. And I think that's partly why Spielberg got his Oscar for that particular film, because he was mostly a blockbuster director up to that point, and that was his art film. It came out the same year he did Jurassic Park. And it is a film that, I gotta be honest, I've seen once and I don't think I can watch again. Not because I don't like it, but because it is very real. And trying to watch something that is about that kind of real mass violence that feels very real to me, I can't take that for too long. It's one thing when it's sort of fantasy violence, and it's like, some guy got cut by a sword that's flaming, right, and there's a dragon in the background, right? I can handle some of that violence because I can detach myself a bit, but when it's about violence that actually occurred, I can't. I mean, there's a reason why I can't watch Bowling for Columbine again, because it's dealing with a real subject. And when I'm hearing, this is one thing that I like about Michael Moore, is that, whatever you think of him as a documentary filmmaker and whatever you think of his politics, he is really good at hitting your emotional buttons when it comes to those films. I mean, there's a brilliant moment in his Fahrenheit 9/11 where he turns out all the lights and all you hear is the sound of the planes hitting the towers and screaming people for like 5 minutes. And it's one of the most affecting pieces, because you suddenly you're not looking at what is the spectacle of what's happening, you're hearing it. And I feel like that creates a more personal connection. There's a reason why I can't watch that film again either. Those kinds of things, just, they're too real.
Mm-hmm.
It's the reason I struggle a lot, like a lot with the media and news, because it feels to me like it comes in two stripes anymore. And these are generalizations, but one stripe is inane happenings, like which celebrity is wearing what dress today. And then there's another stripe that is akin to what you're describing, where, and I see this, I swear to God, almost every day, some father or mother has gone into the home of the other spouse and killed the other spouse and the kids. And we're talking about infants. I saw one the other day, two teenage boys killed their parents and their siblings. They were gracious enough to leave the like 2-year-old alive, or maybe that was an oversight on their part. But I see these stories all the time, and they always bothered me. I'd be lying if I didn't say that once I was a parent myself, it strikes a chord on another level for me. But it's really hard for me to read the news, because I see this one kind of news story that I just don't give a shit about, and this other story that just makes me think, as a race, we're not so terribly evolved. And again, I sound so fucking preachy, and I don't mean to be, but I'm about had it with the news. And these are real stories. These are real people in real lives. And I want desperately to be able to do something about it. But here I am, you know, working at Microsoft by day and writing my stories as best I can. And one of the only things I can do is try and you know, bring as much honesty to these kinds of topics to the page as I can, in the hopes that, like, people actually, when affected deeply by a story and they're moved, are changed. I had this conversation with Rothfuss one time, and it doesn't mean that people need to write cause fiction or that all stories need to be like this, but because the topic that we're talking about today is traumatic events, it's like, if you're going to deal with these, I think it behooves the writer to do it as honestly as they can. I don't think you can do it, or I don't think you should do it blithely. And I think the aim should be that through dealing with it as honestly as you can, people can find comfort, even if it's only in commiseration, or they can find hope in the idea that others get it, right? Wouldn't it be great if you finished a book and said, God, you know what? I think that writer actually understands what the fuck it means that I went through this. It doesn't mean that we're going to be friends or anything, but I can tell you, I've had people reach out to me as a result of book two in ways that I wouldn't have expected, because, you know, I just looked at some shit, I think, just kind of squarely.
Stina, did you want to jump in?
I find it interesting that you're talking about the news and such in as it is now. It used to be a lot worse. When I was a kid, I grew up with the Vietnam War actually on the television.
Yeah, that's a very interesting period when it comes to the news.
Yeah, actually were seeing people killed and shot.
Well, and
burned and all of that.
Yeah,
stuff and right there.
And to some degree, the effect of that was that a lot of people turned against the war.
Yes.
Because it was so graphic, which I think the concern now.
I believe, is absolutely why they will not show anything involving a war on television now.
Well, if you recall, I mean, you're right that they don't show the violence in specific detail. In fact, the government has at times tried to cancel, like, hide certain images, like, you know, a helicopter mowing down civilians or something. But I seem to recall, and I found this really fascinating, because I was in my early academic career, when we invaded Iraq, there was a big to-do about it on the news. It was this, you know, whatever the name of the operation was, I can't remember now, and we actually watched on the news live.
Desert Storm.
Well, I'm sorry, live with quotes around it, because it probably wasn't actually live, right? But that we watched the tanks rolling down in the run for Baghdad, and it was like this big, like, it was like a sporting event, like whichever tank got there first won the big prize.
Yep.
And that, when I went and started to learn about how the Vietnam War was covered, it was in such stark contrast, because the Vietnam War, right, it is sensationalist to a degree, but it is also all these really gruesome images that are coming out, and gives people back home a sense of the horrors of war that they otherwise would not get, because they wouldn't be seeing these images. Whereas you get something like the Iraq War, where it was like an adventure. It was like we were all going to have a big, it was like Teddy Roosevelt on horses, you know, like marching the cavalry down, like a big mythical event, versus like we're going to war.
Yeah.
Going to kill people. We're going to kill hundreds of thousands of people. And there's like no conversation about this at all.
Yeah, in fact, I had gone in to see, Dancing with Wolves, right? And I think it was like 3 hours long or whatever. And then I walked into the theater, I walked out of the theater, we were at war. And on the drive home, I actually saw someone in a big old pickup truck, the United States, huge United States flag and a flagpole in the back of his truck, racing up and down the highway because, you know, you're America. And I was just completely offended by that that attitude. People were dying, and he was just, yoo-hoo, it's football!
Yeah, and it kind of goes to, I mean, what Peter was, you were saying much earlier about, and what we had talked about probably about 10 minutes ago, with the idea of treating subjects like death and rape and whatever as these kind of flippant things that just sort of happen for shock value. They happen in mass amounts. The same kind of thing, like, we couldn't even be bothered to have the conversation, the ethical conversation about the fact that we were going to be killing hundreds of thousands of people, some of whom were innocent, right? Setting aside all the politics of the Iraq War, like innocent people die in war all the damn time, right? That's a consequence of war. And whether or not, like, we weren't having that as part of the conversation about whether we wanted to go to war. And I feel like that's sort of exactly what happens when you get these sort of flippant treatments in books, where it's like there's no conversation about the consequences of what is happening. It's sort of like, you know, I love Tarantino, and Tarantino, I think, deliberately uses violence in a way to kind of highlight how absurd violence is. Sometimes he does this.
Yeah, I can't watch Tarantino.
But, like, Kill Bill is a great example. There's this big sword fight towards the end of either Volume 1 or Volume 2. I can't remember. Huge sword fight. And she just mows down, like, all these people, and she just, like, cuts, like, heads off and arms and limbs, and she's just, like, blood everywhere and just killing all these people. It's like that moment, right, where it's sort of, like, we're just seeing the death, but what are the consequences of any of those deaths? It doesn't appear like there's any, right? Do we have a character covered in blood? What are the, like, what, how does, like, people don't react to being covered in human blood, like, really, like, even someone who's a little effed up is gonna be, like, upset by that. I mean, yeah. I don't know about you, but if you covered me in human blood, I would freak out.
Let me give you an interesting example. It's going to sound comic, but I think it underscores your point.
Okay.
One of my favorite new shows on the Weather Channel is called Fat Guys in the Woods. And it's...
Wait, that's its exact title?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Oh my God, that's... Does it give you exactly what it advertises?
So... It sounds ridiculous, but let me tell you, there's this trend in recent years of these survivalist shows. There was Bear Grylls and his thing. There was Survivor Man, and these are people who are trained survivalists, and they go out and they survive in these extreme conditions. And you actually, if you watch close, you learn techniques for how, if you were in those things, to survive. So good, right? I was a Boy Scout, glad to brush up on things and learn things I didn't know. This show has another guy who dedicated his whole life to understanding how you survive. And people who call in to go on his show are usually people who are hitting crossroads in their lives. They're inactive, right? And so they go out into the woods and they spend 5 days. And they have to get right back to the basics, building a shelter, building a fire, securing water, securing food. And they go through this process of all of the extraneous shit in life is stripped away, and it's just survive. And you see these stories of these people who kind of confront this kind of thing and have these life-changing experiences. And part of that, to bring this back to what you were talking about, is many of them was they're confronted with having to secure food, end up trapping a bird or a squirrel or something. And in some of them, they have to take the life of that animal. And they show these grown men, like, and these are big guys, right? They're not just like, these are big guys. They look, you know, rough and tumble, all of that stuff. Breaking down and crying over having to do this kind of thing. And this is an animal, mind you. So, you know, like, if math follows, how much more so does a human get sort of traumatized by having to take the life of another human, even in war? And that's documented. We've seen that before. So I think you're right. I think you got to have that conversation, even if you decide in the end that the military action is justified for whatever reason. And the thing that I did in this last book is I said, you know, yes, there's going to be people who are going to go and figure out how it is we're going to try and escalate to meet this big bad threat, right? Epic fantasy, that's what you do. But one of my main characters had the counter notion, which is, hey, maybe instead of escalating to war, we should figure out how to prevent war before it starts. That's his whole plot thread. And it was very, very interesting for me to write, a sort of very aggressive plot arc for a character who was using science to try and find a way to prevent war at the same time that, you know, others were escalating to war. Mm-hmm. I found it very informative. I'd love to see more fiction where, you know, you see the dissenters who are everybody's smart, everybody's capable, who have a different way to solve a problem.
I think that's cool. Honestly, I'm glad you did that. That's not something that's explored in fantasy very often, particularly epic fantasy. That's a great idea. I like to see that.
Yeah, it certainly isn't as common a thread that, you know, the idea that we need to do everything we can to sort of avoid war, because the consequence, especially in a fantasy setting, because so many people die, and it's not like there's just billions of people walking around ready to go, right? You know, you're dealing with these faux medieval worlds where we're probably dealing with, like, you know, 20 million people on the whole planet, not 7 billion. And so the consequences, again, right? If you're writing a fantasy novel and you have a war, right? Like, nobody just goes home from that and it's all like hunky dory, right? Tons of resources are used to make that war go. And then all the lives that don't come back. And what happens to the fields that are full of dead bodies and blood?
You don't just go out and farm that.
No, right? I mean, like, presumably those fields they're no good for, like, a long time. Because it's full of decaying... I don't know. I don't know anything about this, but I'm assuming they must have done something with the bodies. Or they Yeah.
It's one of the things I did in my series is... I made it a bit more fantastical than that, but I made one of the... one of the prices for one of the magic systems is it's like a transference of energy. And so when the bad guys are wielding their magic and they're finding a source, they're literally taking the sort of vitality from anything and everything other than themselves. And so when they're done on one of the major battles at one of the historical wars, There's a great swath of land that's left essentially barren. It becomes known as the Scar. And I did that very deliberately. It ties back to what I was saying before, where there's the lives of these young kids who end up so sort of ravaged that they're kind of emotionally scarred, such that some of them choose to leave this life by their own hand rather than endure it for all of its suffering. So that you see the consequences of war in kind of multiple ways, right? And by the way, I didn't have to make any of that shit up because, you know, look at the suicide rates for veterans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of wonder about the suicide rates because on violence poses some interesting thoughts in that regard. During the Civil War, for example, He's got a lot of... I can't find the book right now, otherwise I'd quote from it. There's some interesting data regarding firing rates that during a lot of the excavation of the battlefields, they found a lot of weapons with that had been loaded many times but never fired. So there's this really interesting data about the percentage of people who actually fire on human beings previous to Vietnam was actually really low.
Yeah, even in World War II, they've done studies, yep. You know, how many bullets were fired versus how many they suspect were actually fired at people.
Yes.
Versus,
there's a percentage of people who cannot fire the gun at all. There's a percentage of people who can fire the gun, just not at people. Then there's a percentage, very small percentage of people who actually fire the guns at people. Very small percentage. And what usually happens is these other people, this 80% of the people out on the field that can't bring themselves to fire on the other side because they're human beings, they are they're not cowards. They're actually going out there and in the line of just running out and saving, pulling the wounded off the field. They're assisting the one person who can fire by making sure that their weapon is loaded. All of this stuff. So it's, again, I really want to recommend that book. It's really amazing. But after, right around Vietnam War, the Army decided, after doing all these studies, that wasn't efficient. And so they figured out a system to make it such that everyone, they changed the rates to be around 90% people actually firing, as opposed to only, what, I think it was like 23% or something. Jeez. So that has a cost. That really does. And I don't even know. He didn't cover it in the book. He didn't discuss it. He didn't address it. I don't know that our government puts back the things that they took out in order to let someone fire on somebody else like that who wouldn't normally do so.
Well, and the bigger question would be, can they put it back? Exactly. Do they know how?
Exactly.
I mean, if you think about it, PTSD research, I mean, like, the honest research on PTSD begins after Vietnam.
Yes.
I mean, before they called it things like shell shock,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I remember reading about some of the people who had basically had PTSD after World War II or even during it, and just they snapped and they couldn't function, and they just basically said, yeah, you just need to like go in a infirmary for like a couple months and just get over it.
Yeah. There's another book called What Is It Like to Go to War by Carl Merlantis.
Okay.
I've done a lot of research on war and soldiers because I do write about them. And I do have that thing where I can't write about something that traumatic without doing my homework as much as I possibly can. So it's a great book, and it actually talks about and addresses things that people might do in order to help heal that. It's really very interesting. So yeah, I would recommend On Violence, and then follow that up with What Is It Like to Go to War?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, one thing, a couple threads that have sort of come up a lot through this is, you know, not treating the subject flippantly. That's kind of been the big one. You know, do your research, right? Insofar as it's possible, right? I don't know if there may be subjects that maybe there's no research on. I don't know. And I think, although we've not said it explicitly, but empathy is the big piece.
Oh yeah.
Like, thinking about, like, I mean, as Peter and Yusina, right, have brought up, we've all brought up, I guess, is the idea that there are consequences for the actions we take. And when it comes to traumatic actions, the kinds of consequences that are dealt with, like, you need to be empathetic to what those are. Even if you've never personally experienced them, you need to be able to stick yourself in that space so that you can actually treat it as something that isn't flippant, right? Isn't something you just kind of just toss out there, but is actually something that has real human value.
Yeah, it's the difference. I won't reveal my source because he may or may not want to have this attribution, but I'm fond sometimes of taking straw polls of readers and writers and editors on different questions. And probably some of you have even been in some of these, but one of them, an editor for a fan site, used the term in regard to fantasy, the two terms. One is the sort of more traditional approach to fantasy, and another is what he called comic book fantasy. And I found that a useful shorthand for the difference between fantasy that I read, where it feels like for all of the fantastical trappings that are still there, the writer's making a real effort to put humans on the page, versus other where it feels more like a comic book. It feels more like, it doesn't mean that it's not exciting, and it may be at a particular point in your life or in your day, it's not precisely the kind of fiction you want to read. It's not to denigrate it at all.
No, it's doesn't make it mean it's not worthy.
Right.
No, that's right. But it's the intention with this other kind of fantasy is to not necessarily go at topics and, you know, the question of the human condition and the consequences of traumatic events in the same light. It really is more of, hey, this is the structure in order for me to move to act two or three or four. And that's legitimate. Like, you know, every art form has its place. I think, though, that a lot of what we're describing here is a way of approaching fiction for a type of, you know, mostly what we're talking about, genre, a type of genre fiction where it's the former as opposed to the latter.
Yeah, I think variety is the important thing. For me, I wanted to write about violence that way because, again, it just seemed to be so flippant in action films. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger guns somebody down and has the comedic quotes afterward seem to be like the thing. It not only is death not worth shedding a tear over, it's something we laugh at for some reason. Right. I like to approach the idea that maybe vengeance isn't the ideal that action films want to tell us it is. It's not the ideal answer for every single problem. I think I want to spread around the idea that maybe we ought to think about that. As much as I write about guns and war and all that stuff, I don't think that I don't own a gun and I never will. I don't want to. I don't like the fact that in Texas we have this open carry thing. It terrifies me. I just think we need to stop and think more than it just worries me.
Think versus react.
Yes,
because that's the thing that happened in Texas was interesting because I found out about it because Whataburger apparently came out publicly and said they don't want customers to openly carry in their stores.
Yep.
Because from their perspective it makes people uncomfortable, and we need to give a comfortable experience to the maximum number of customers we possibly can because we care, right? We're a place for like Boy Scouts and kids and all kinds of family, right? I mean, it's a Whataburger, so it's a fast food restaurant, but and remember the reaction was it was just like, oh my gosh, you're violating Texas state law and you're doing all this stuff. Of course, they're not violating Texas
Nope.
state law. The law even has provisions in it that say that private businesses can actually say no, right?
Yeah.
But the reaction, right? It was the reaction of anger at the idea versus like really thinking about it. Like,
yep.
Well, imagine, right? Like how you would feel if like someone showed up at a Whataburger while you were there with your pistol and they brought a tank and a bazooka.
If you have a gun, that's the first and only solution that will come to mind.
Not always true, but you know, I mean, there are, I know some gun owners who are really, 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 like, they don't even like gun culture in the U.S. They own a gun because they're hunters, or in some cases, they just own a gun because they like going to a firing range.
That's okay. But if you're carrying it around with you every day, it's right there. It's available. It's really easy to, and the films industry makes it look like, okay, you have a problem. You can shoot somebody. The problem is done. There's no consequences for that. It's the problem is done. Somebody's radio is too loud in their car. You can just shoot them and that'll be the answer to the problem. You know, that worries me. I don't have a problem with target shooting. I don't have a problem with hobbyists who happen to like guns and happen to like to shoot them on ranges. What I have a problem with is this false idea that it is somehow more secure to have one in the house. We'll get back to
So we don't dive too deep into that. Peter, last thought, and then we have to kind of close out here.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to something you said, which I like a lot, is this idea of empathy. But we'll say again that there's kinds of fiction that don't need to take this as a theme at all, and they can be wonderful and fun and all of that. But for the stripe of fiction where you're striving to kind of plumb those depths and you know, evince a more resonant human reaction to the reading experience, I would say that empathy is core. You know, I'm biased in this regard because when I was conceiving of in my series, when I was conceiving of what I thought would be the very worst possible thing as for the you know, what is effectively the bad guys, the bad cultures, it was the lack of empathy, which scares me to death. Because a person with no empathy, you know, what sort of what internal guidance do they have? In terms of how they show regard or interrelate with other people. What it would horrifying in the kinds of things they would do, because there would be no restraint. The idea of restraint may even be foreign. And so, but you know, the other side of that coin is when you're going to deal with things like rape or death or suicide, these kinds of things, you can empathize. And I really like it's, I don't want to mandate, man, but I really think you kind of should empathize if you're going to write these kinds of things. Cause I think if you don't, it's a little irresponsible. And at the very least, as a writer, you're just not doing enough of the real work. I really believe that.
I agree.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting too that, you know, this example you gave us of the fat guys in the woods, and the image of these big men crying over having to kill like a squirrel or something, basically with their bare hands. It goes to that exact problem, which is that, you know, faced with the act of having to actually kill your own food, I suspect most people would be incapable of doing it.
Because I think there would be a lot more vegetarians.
There would be a lot more vegetarians if, like, there were, like, I'm not saying we should have this, but if there were a law that said everyone has to kill their own food, they have to go out and, like, you know, slit a pig's throat, right? I suspect most people would be incapable of doing it because of that I think most people do have empathy, but it becomes really easy if you live in a society where you're removed from that, because let's be honest, most of us don't, like, well, I don't know about most of us on this show, but most people don't live really close to a farm where they regularly deal with these kinds of things, right? Especially not factory meat farms. So yeah. We're detached from it, right? We see the food when it is a steak. We don't see the food, like, we don't see the axe as it's being produced into the steak. We miss all those other steps. We just get the part where we get the num-nums. And I do think that's really interesting that's what happens when people are faced with that decision, as suddenly they can't turn the empathy off, right? They feel for this creature and and in some cases, I imagine on that show, maybe in some cases they don't eat it. They let it go.
Yeah. That's some interesting conversations happen around, you know, cause when you get to your fifth day without food and you're forced, you know, you feel like you've got to eat. But you know, so you're probably in a sensitive place emotionally anyway, and then you're forced with having to do something that you're uncomfortable with, but feel like you're pressed up against, you know, a nourishment need. That's why I think that it's gone beyond some of these crazy traditional survival shows. And I also think it's why, like, it's interesting to me. I have friends who've grown up on farms where they see the circle of life. They live it. And there's a different sensibility about a person who kind of has grown up with that versus someone who's basically had a silver spoon up their ass their whole life. And I'm one of those. So, like, I'm not throwing stones here. I think it's why when writers are wanting to tackle some of these issues, Stina does her research. I know when I wrote an as yet unpublished book when I did a bunch of research on the Vietnam War. And it was back where we started. It was with this friend of mine who'd been there. And I read some books, but the best information I got was talking to him about his experiences there. And if you want to get down to the bone, talk to a vet about what it's like to go to war.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You'll get a perspective that a history book can't provide.
Well, yeah, that's why I made sure when I wrote about the Troubles, I spoke to people who had lived through it. There are aspects of research that aren't covered by the textbooks. There are things that aren't recorded. There are things that everyone who's lived through it doesn't talk about because everybody knows. And thus it doesn't get recorded. And I'm not even talking about deeply emotional, traumatic stuff. I'm talking about simple things. Like, for example, in Northern Ireland in the 1970s, they could tell the difference, they still can, between a Catholic and a Protestant without, you know, I was reading these passages, and it was like, oh, I was standing on the street corner and a bus full of Catholics went past. The bus did not have a sign on the side of it that said, this is a bus full of Catholics. But they knew just looking at it. Or, you know, someone said, I went down the street and I saw a Catholic walk by. They didn't have a big old sign that says, I am a Catholic, hanging off of them.
There's just something about it that they could tell.
Yeah. And so one of the first questions I had of Brian when I started writing about this, it was, I don't know how you can tell. How can you tell? And it's little tiny details like how someone pronounces the letter H. When they're talking. Yeah. For example, when they're talking about the H blocks, it's H blocks. There's just the tiny little, what side of the street they walk on. Just all kinds of crazy things like that you wouldn't even think about that are there, but are never recorded in the historic findings. None of that is.
Interesting. Interesting. So, we are getting toward the end of our time, so we do need to move on to you guys talking about what you've basically been talking about, which is your books, but in a very different context. So, Stina, your book came out at the time of recording roughly 2 weeks ago. It is called Cold Iron. It is the first in a new series of what some are calling Flintlock Fantasy. I don't recall if that's what you're calling it, but let's pretend that's what you called it too. and would you tell everybody a little bit about the book? And you know, it's obviously very different in some respects than some of your other work.
Yeah, I do call it a Flintlock Fantasy. For me, the question, every author generally has a question when they start writing, a what if. And for me, the what if was, what if Tolkien were American, what would fantasy look like? Largely, fantasy right now it relies a lot on monarchy and or feudalism or whatever. Those are all very. It's much more British kind of background, and I really wanted to see what an epic fantasy might look like in a democracy kind of situation. So. I start with the monarchy because, you know, it's really hard to write an epic fantasy. It really is hard to do that and step away from it. But eventually they will end up in a democracy, with a democracy. So there's that. There are three main characters. There's Suvi and Nels, the twins, who inherit the kingdom. Suvi ends up being the queen, and Nels ends up leading the army. And I don't know, things go horribly awry. I'm so tired. I'm sorry.
It's okay. The good news is the book is out, and people can go get it now. And I am looking on the internets at this moment. The paperback version is $10.68 on Amazon. That's interesting. But you know what? It's at your local store, so go buy 800 copies now.
Yeah.
So, perfect. And Peter, your second book came out a couple months ago in May. It's the second book in the Vault of Heaven series called Trial of Intentions. And also earlier this year, they re-released what I guess is like the director's cut version of The Unremembered, which is your first book. Which I thought was really interesting when that came in, and I was like, why are they sending me this book again? And then I looked and I was like, oh, it's special. That's kind of cool. So tell people a little bit about Trial of Intentions.
Well, it's the second book in the series. For a lot of reasons I won't go into, there was a lot of delay between books one and two. And so I wrote book two as an entry point, which means, you know, for anybody who's listening, if they're interested in checking out the series, they can start with Trial of Intentions. They don't need to necessarily feel like they gotta go back and read the first book. And, you know, this is where I'd had this sort of romantic idea, because I adore the genre so much, that I would write a gateway book with the first book in order to bring more people into you know, genre reading by writing something that traded on some of the familiar conventions. And then in book two, Trial of Intentions, is where so much of what I think is unique about my world really kind of kicks into high gear. I developed something I call a governing dynamic that I call resonance. And it's like a principle of you know, like mechanical law, like gravity or magnetism in my world, that underlies so far 5 different magic systems. So different cultures tap it differently, so they look like different magic systems, but the reader understands they have this unifying principle. And it's called resonance. And this really comes to the fore in book two. And what that means is things like the music magic system, you really start to see how it is the music magic works. And my character, she does some training and she becomes really conversant with her own ability. There's this whole thing where I set you up to believe that I've got an orphan farm boy, but turns out he's far from an orphan farm boy. And I violate that expectation. And you learn that there's an entire city of science. It's not science so that you can learn how to do magic better. It's science. It's astronomy and physics and mathematics and cosmology. And not astrology, cosmology, and real astronomy. And this character goes there, and his intention is to try and find a way to use this understanding and advance it to prevent war. You know, we talked before about suicide. So I take these things and I'm trying to weave them into, you know, into a book that starts to go into new territory for the genre, you know, just cause I want to try and do some things I haven't seen before. You know, and so the characters if you've read the first book that you've come to know, they change a lot in this book. And the consequence is that, there are a lot of things on sort of, collision paths, and, they come to a head pretty catastrophically at the end of the book. So yeah, that's it. And Trial of Intentions sounds like an esoteric title, but, you know, there's an actual sort of almost like litigation thing that takes place in the book where people kind of have to declare their intentions, and they go through this sort of trial mechanic, and can be pretty heartbreaking what happens as a consequence of those trials. So that's where the title came from.
And so just a real quick question, because this is for Rachel, and I know this really matters to her as a scientist, but does your city of science also do geology?
No, no geology. I did, though. Like, I mean, this was bona fide. I had a NASA scientist was one of my beta readers on all the science stuff. So I feel like, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I think I got most of it right. But unfortunately, no geologist. I'm sorry, Rachel.
Well, I can tell you right now, Rachel's not going to read any book until you put a geologist in it, because she doesn't read books that don't have them.
Wow.
This is a true fact. It's totally true. I've tried to get Rachel to read all kinds of books, but she looks at it and she goes, is there a geologist in it? And I'm like, well, no. And she says, well, I can't read it. That's just discriminatory.
It's
so.
Like so many of Sean's facts, the truthiness is not in dispute at all.
It's not in dispute. It's totally truthness.
I should say, though, just to make sure people don't like think that all I'm writing is this heady thing. You know, my whole book starts with a major war for a real reason. And there's, you know, so there's a lot of this stuff that traditional fantasy readers care about in this book, but I'm trying to introduce some things to, I don't know, garnish it in ways that maybe you don't expect. So that was my intention, not to be too punny.
Were you put on trial for that? Oh, come on, guys. Like, that was a good one. Right? Okay. Well, in any case, I'll put links in the show notes to everything so folks can find it. If you go to skiffyandfanny.com, you find the show notes for this episode. But thanks so much, Peter, for joining us for this conversation. Well, thanks first for coming up with a topic and then coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for hosting this. I don't think every podcast would necessarily take this for a topic. So thank you.
You're welcome. Absolutely. And Stina, thanks so much for joining us. And I hope you sent that book to me.
Oh, I'm supposed to send you a book?
Yeah, we had a conversation. I already have Peter's book. Peter, like, he said to his publisher, he was like, make sure Sean gets a book.
And I
know, because there's a note on there that said, Peter threatened to beat us up if we didn't send this. It's true. Well, maybe only part of that's true. I don't think Peter's actually a violent person, so he probably didn't threaten. He said he wouldn't send them cookies is probably what happened. But, Stina, you were supposed to send me that book. What are you doing?
I'm sorry. Armadillo Con happened.
I know, I'm totally teasing you. Okay, all right. I'm being ridiculous. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And do feel free to contact us if you've got anything you'd like to add, comments, or what have you. Obviously, we kind of scratched the surface, so there's a lot more we could talk about. But, well, this isn't a podcast that runs for 12 years. So on that note, this isn't going to be an awkward ending. It's just going to be an ending. So bye.
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 If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.